it's listening to thousands, literally thousands of songs about heartbreak, rejection, pain, misery, and loss. Did I listen to pop music because I was miserable? Or was I miserable because I listened to pop music?
Well, music is my life, man. What do you want me to do?
Hey, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time of day you happen to be listening to this podcast. Welcome. This is Love That Album. This is the Album Discussion Podcast. And I thank you very much for joining us for episode 66 of the program. My name is Morris. And as I like to do on this program, I always invite a guest or two to come and discuss an album, which we like to dissect and talk about, you know, maybe the historical value or the musical value of the album, and where it stands in the whole context of the history of rock and roll. And if you've heard that show, the show before, then you know all that, so I'm sorry to bore you. But if this is the first time that you're listening in, now you're in the know. And welcome on board. Thank you so much for tuning in. And I have two guest hosts for this program. Always a pleasure and a privilege to have other people who care enough about music to join me for a discussion. So I will introduce the first guest is someone who's a return visitor of the program. He's been on the show, I think, just once before, and that is my good mate from work. We won't say where we work because that'd be unprofessional, but Mr. Dave Blom. Good evening to you, Dave.
Yeah, good evening, Morris. Nice to be back on again.
It's lovely to have you back, and you've gone and selected today's album, which we'll talk about in a minute, what that is. Last time we had you on, we discussed a little bit of King Crimson, which was, I think, your first time listening to In the Court of the Crimson King.
Yeah, and it was my first listening to that album. And I also...
And the Flaming Lips you selected.
Yeah, introduce you to Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots.
Well, sort of. I remember someone had gone and given it to me years before, and, you know, first time listening back there, I thought, oh, I don't really dig this. And then, you know, when you said, no, I want to cover this, and so, oh, I better go back and listen to it. And dig it, I did. You know, so... So nice to have a change of heart after all those years. So thank you very much for that. Before we talk about what album we have selected, I will introduce the second member of our crew tonight. And this is a man, you will have heard me speak about him on the program. He is the co-host of a podcast that I've only discovered, I think, maybe earlier on this year. Was it late last year? I'm not sure. But either way, a show I really love. The name of the show is called The Stinking Pause. That's P-A-U-S-E podcast, a film discussion podcast. One of the show's hosts is a fellow called Charlie, but the fellow who I have on the show tonight is his partner in crime, Mr. Scott Phipps. Good evening, Scott.
Good evening over there. Good morning from here. How are you?
Ah, that's right. Yes, morning. 10:45 Saturday morning for you.
It is not too early, thankfully.
Well, you know, I think it's a gentlemanly hour. Would you not agree? Yeah,
10:45. It's fine. Very civilized.
Unfortunately, whenever we do these podcasts, you know, with people on the other side of the globe and the international timeline and all that sort of thing, I've found that there's usually one of us, if not more, who have to be up at fairly uncivilized time. On my other show, See Here, poor Wendy is often left having to be up at like 5:30 in the morning to record. I don't think she, you know, really likes that terribly much, but, you know. Anyway, no, thank you very much, Scott. I'll quickly mention what album it is that we're covering tonight, and then I'd like to get you to talk a little bit about the Stinking Pause podcast for those people out there who haven't tuned into it yet. But the album that we're going to be talking about on today's show, which, as I said, was a selection from Dave, is one of the final albums in the slew of the period known as Britpop, and that is Manson's Attack of the Grey Lantern. So I'll be asking you soon, Dave, to talk about why it is that you selected that album and why it is that you love it. But before we get into that, I'd like to ask you both a little bit about what you've been listening to of late. First of all, I guess, Scott, for listeners out there who haven't had the good fortune to download yet the Stinking Pause podcast, tell them what they've been missing and why they should be missing and the format.
Yeah, the Stinking Pause podcast. It's a movie review podcast, as you can probably guess from the name, you know, linked to Planet of the Apes and Charlton Heston. Get your stinking paws off of me. It's my good friend Charlie and I, who, as you say, unfortunately can't be with us today. And we chat for a good couple of hours every 2 weeks or so, and we review three movies at a time. No general rules as to what we review, but we try to keep the movies 10 years or older. We're aiming towards the classic side of movies rather than the newer stuff. Mm-hmm. We throw in a bit of music, a few quizzes, general conversation, and a lot of interaction from our listeners, which is always great. So been running now for about 18 months. Episode 34 we recorded last week. That should be out in a couple of days' time. And yeah, we're just working towards the end of the year where we're going to be broadcasting fortnightly, hopefully. Got a few, you know, shows up our sleeve ready to go. So
excellent. And we were speaking off air about another potential project that you have lined up for next year. Would you like to spill the beans here? You know, a world first. I love that album. Tell us about your next venture.
It's in its embryonic stages at the moment. It was a crazy idea that Charlie and I had that, partly influenced by your good selves and your love of music, we wanted to do some sort of music-based podcast as well as a movie one. And we tried to think of a format that possibly hasn't been done. And as we spoke earlier, that most people like a list or two. And Rolling Stone magazine over the past 20 years have done two top 500 album polls. And rather than go through them sequentially, one to 500 or 500 through to one, we're going to pick them randomly. So it's going to throw some real crazy albums at us, some stuff we've never heard of, and possibly some favourites as well. Possibly only a half-hour format, and we're just going to just see how it goes. We're looking at possibly January or February when that's going to take the air. So looking for a name for the podcast as well. So as I say, still early stages, but it's something that Charlie and I are really looking forward to doing.
It sounds like absolutely a treat. It'll be an excellent an excellent show. I wondered, do you know, is Ad Nauseam by Derek and Clive in the top 500?
It's not, but we may bring that in as a special guest episode.
It'd be right up Charlie's alley.
It certainly would, and I will not edit any of the swearing that happens in that at all.
Oh, you could talk about Derek and Clive and cut out any of the swearing. You'd not get much dialogue in them.
There'd be nothing. It'd just be bleeps all the way through. Yeah.
Oh yeah! Actually, what I really want to do is I want to hear Charlie sit down at the piano and sing us a rousing chorus of "Jump." And I'm not talking about the Van Halen song here, folks.
No, I know.
Look up Derek.
I know the
slide. And jump. Anyway, so no, that's really fantastic. I'll be much looking forward to hearing you do that. And what have you got coming up on the next episode of Stinking Paws, the next couple of episodes of Stinking
Paws?
Yeah,
we've got two that I'm going to be editing today. Episode 33 should be available as of today or tomorrow. And it's our usual format of three movies. And we looked at Howard Hawks' classic Rio Bravo, which I believe is one of your favourite films.
I profess I actually haven't seen it. It's one that I've said I want to watch. You know what? I remember reading a quote from Quentin Tarantino where he once said, when I'm dating a new woman, I show her Rio Bravo, and she'd better fucking like it. But I'm embarrassed to say it's just one of those Pantheon films, and I've got a lot of Pantheon films that have passed me by, but unfortunately that's one of them. But I will attempt to rectify that before I listen to the podcast, so I might see if I can track it down this week.
Yeah, it's certainly one of Scott Clicker's favourites. I think he's saving it for Cat as well, he said, for a special occasion, so... It's highly regarded by a lot of people, that movie. We also looked at Seven Samurai, because what we also do is celebrate the anniversary or the birthday of a movie, and Seven Samurai was released in 1954, so that was our birthday movie for this week.
Oh, only 60 years.
Yeah, incredible. But watching it, it doesn't seem like a 60-year-old movie. There's so much stuff that, you know, it went on to influence. You know, obviously The Magnificent Seven was based on it. And Kurosawa himself was influenced by people like Howard Hawks and John Ford, because it is almost like a Western.
So I believe that Kurosawa was for the longest time not really taken seriously in Japan, because they said you tend to depend too much on American directors rather than looking into your own backyard. And I gather for that reason someone like Ozu was held in higher regard than he was. But I think that's just insane, because he took some of those Western traits and put the Japanese spin on it. And they look completely to me like he's looking in his own backyard for these films.
Yeah, I mean, we were doing some research behind the movie before we broadcast, and we discovered that Kurosawa himself was from a family of samurai. Which obviously,
oh, really?
Yeah, his father, I believe, actually was still classed as a samurai. So it's quite interesting, you know, to see that he's taking those Eastern family references and mixing them with the Western influences that he grew up and loved watching on the screen. So, yeah, it was an eye opener for us. And Charlie has been devouring Kurosawa ever since.
I saw in his letterboxd page that he'd recently watched Akira, and that is like, I don't think I've ever made like a top 10 films, but if I do, that's in it. Akira is, have you seen that one?
I haven't, but I think Charlie gave it 5 stars on Letterboxd.
Yeah, it's, well, he's, by giving it 5 out of 5, he's undersold it. At least a 6 out of 5.
Well, that's all magnificent. He said, could I give Seven Samurai a 6? He said, because he was totally blown away by it. And, I think he watched Yojimbo as well. He's catching up on the back catalogue now. So, and the third movie, It's a bit of a stinking paws tradition that we tend to gravitate towards 1970s American movies. And for some reason, a lot of them seem to be set in New York and they're sort of cop movies or crime-based films. And my choice for Charlie this week was The French Connection from 1971 with Gene Hackman and Roy Scheider.
Nice.
One of my favourites. Again, Charlie loved it. It was interesting to see it after quite a few years. I hadn't seen it for a while, but it hasn't lost any of its magic. I mean, Friedkin as a director is absolutely phenomenal. We remarked on just the whole use of location and the improvisation of the scenes, and the car chase is well, it's gone down in cinema history as one of the greatest car chases ever.
Right.
And it was a great episode to record. We sort of hit the big guns this time around with 3 major classic movies. And episode 34, which I'm also going to be editing today. We recorded about 2 nights ago. We're going to do a brief sort of Halloween tribute. We're going to do a one-off special, and we're reviewing The Shining with Jack Nicholson.
Nice, nice. I listened to your substitute Married with Clickers discussion about Rosemary's Baby. It looked like there was you gained a whole bunch of new fans as a result of that. A lot of people
who hadn't
heard your show before. It was quite a coup.
Yeah, we've got a lot of new friends and listeners out there, and it really done us a lot of favours. That whole format that Scott and Kat do of just recording one movie for about 30, 45 minutes or so, Charlie and I quite like it, and we're going to try and do that a little bit more often rather than rely on the 2.5 hour extended specials that we do. So look right out for a couple of extra episodes over the next few months that we're just going to do one-off movies.
Nice. Okay, well, so if you want to find your podcast, the listeners out there, you have to, of course, be aware it's Stinking Paws, P-A-U-S-E, not P-A-W-S. So go onto iTunes and search for Stinking P-A-U-S-E. Our website, what's your
at the moment, we've got a blog. I'm working on a website, which is going to go live in about a week or two, which is a lot more user-friendly and a bit more involved. There's a few other bits in there, like our Stinking Paws Village Hall of Fame, where we actually honour people that have appeared 3 times on the show, actors and directors and composers, things like that. And there's going to be a whole page dedicated to them on the website. But for the moment, you can find us at thestinkingpaws.blogspot.co.uk. There's a Facebook group, which you are a member of, Morris, and actively
take part.
And you can find us on Twitter, at Stinking Paws. So we're there, all the usual outlets.
Terrific. And Dave, you're there.
Morris.
So we won't be talking film with you. We'll be talking music. What's the story? What have you been listening to of late? Now, before we talk about that, what you've been listening to of late, I'd like to just sort of reiterate my thanks to you. Dragged me into seeing a gig with you a couple of months ago for a band which has been in Melbourne, playing around Melbourne for 20 or 21 years, and your reference to them was the first I'd heard of them, and I like to sort of think I'd heard of a whole bunch of bands around our fair town, but you put me onto Spoonful, and what I saw them on the night was just absolutely blew me away.
You're welcome, Morris. They are really something of a Melbourne institution, I suppose. Recently, I just saw the drummer, Kip Warhurst's band Rocket Science, whom You're very familiar with the lead singer, Roman Tucker.
I am indeed. He was on my opposition team when I was on an episode in the first season of Rock Quiz. I was with Renee Geyer, and Roman Tucker was on the opposition team. He was quite funny and very talented. So there you go. The little bit of footage that I saw from that show, it looked quite wild. Unfortunately, the audio was a bit in clip. But, yeah, it looked like an absolutely wild gig that you went to.
Yeah, crazy gig for Mick Blood from the Lime Spiders.
Mm. Wow, fantastic. And so what else have you been listening to of late?
Well, I'm just slowly wrapping my ears around Augie March's new album called Haven's Dam. Mm-hmm. And they really do have a nice sort of George Harrison type sound this time around.
Okay. So when you say George Harrison type of sound, what are we talking about? We're talking about like All Things Must Pass era, or we're talking about, you know, because really the early stuff sounds like a mile away from you know, where he went to, like the last, well, you know, the Wilbury stuff, or what was the last album that he put out, Brainwashed or something. I think a lot of those Dark Horse
labels. And Cloud Nine, those Cloud type Nine, of ones.
Yeah. Did it sound more like
no.
that?
No, it definitely sounds more All Things Must Pass.
Okay. Well, yeah, no, I'll definitely be interested in giving that a listen. I've sort of not really given too much attention to Augie March. I'd heard a little bit and didn't melodically capture me at first, but you know, certainly comparing it to something like All Things Must Pass is high praise. So, yep, I'll definitely search that out.
And definitely when you see them live, it's really a toss of the coin. Some nights they can be the most fantastic band in the world, and other times you just wonder if they really do care.
So you're comparing them to Bob Dylan, basically.
Yeah, very much so. Also, I'm looking forward to finally getting down to watching a little sort of mini-series that showed on the ABC recently called The War That Changed Us. And it features the music of a little folk duo out of Melbourne called the Orb Weavers, who I've been raving about.
You put me onto them, and they're pretty fantastic. They are pretty wonderful. I'm trying to think. I'd love to go see them play, like if they're down the Caravan Club down my way. I'm getting a bit too old and too boring, sort of travelling to the north side of the city too much.
It's a very regular haunt of theirs.
The Caravan.
Yeah.
I really ought to be paying more attention. But, the tracks that you played for me, they are really, really wonderful stuff. So, listeners out there, go search Orb Weavers, ORBWEAVERS, and check them out. So anything else that you want to mention? Listening to? Digging?
No, just looking forward to the release of the new Spoonful album and getting out there and seeing a bit more gigs.
So presumably they'll do a big album launch, huh?
Yeah, at the Spotted Mallard.
Ah, okay. All right. Yep. Now if they're on a Saturday night, I might have to join you for that, I think.
No worries.
All right. Okay. So, as I said, we're going to be discussing Manson's Attack of the Grey Lantern on this program. We're going to go to a break. Before we do go to the break, I'll now lead into our good friend Eric Reanimator. If this is your first time listening to the show, we have a correspondent from Ann Arbor, Eric Peterson, aka Eric Reanimator, and he always does pretty much like what takes myself and my other guests an hour and a half to 2 hours to talk about. He's very concise. He'll talk about an album that he loves in 10 minutes because he's far more efficient than I am. But this time around, he's going to talk about an album which maybe, Scott, you have some familiarity with. It's a British band called The Wild Hearts, and their album from 1993, Earth Versus the Wild Hearts. Is this something you're familiar with?
Unfortunately, no. I'm not aware of The Wild Hearts at all. This would be interesting. I love Eric's stuff, so it'd be interesting to hear what he's got to say here.
All right. No worries. Well, we'll go play Eric's segment, have a bit of a promo for another show. And then we'll come back shortly to talk about Manson. You're listening to Love That Album. Thanks for joining us.
Take it away, Eric, the orchestra leader.
I want two, three, four.
Hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
Now it's time for An Album I Love with Eric Reanimator.
La-dee-dee, 1, 2, 3, Eric the Reanimator.
Scar, the Groovy Ghoulies, Turbo Negro, and the Wild Hearts. When I think of cult bands from the 1990s, those are the bands that come to mind, and the last of those, the Wild Hearts, what I'm going to be talking about today, and their 1993 album, Earth vs. the Wild Hearts. Formed in 1989, the Wild Hearts really took off during the 90s, where their mix of Metallica-style heavy metal with melodic power pop might seem a odd combination, but if you go back to episode 44 of Love That Album, you will hear me review an album by another band that was kind of playing with that idea, the Galactic Cowboys. I talked about their album Machine Fish. They were pulling the Metallica-style thrash heavy metal and mixing it with Beatlesque four-part harmonies and power pop melodies, and it should come as no surprise that the main songwriter, or one of the main songwriters from the Galactic Cowboys, Monty Colvin, who was the cousin of Dee Dee Ramone, is actually a huge fan of the Wild Hearts. So the Wild Hearts cult kind of grew mainly in Europe. You'd find a couple people in the States that knew about them and knew their music. But as an underground sensation, like the other bands I mentioned at the top, the Wild Hearts have grown and grown. And let's take a listen why.
Busy Karen, 'cause that's all she's ever done. She's a thousand Florence Nightingales all rolled up into one. And people take advantage, but she loves her fellow friend. When strangers die around her, she still cries herself to sleep, and she seldom gets a chance to pick the company she keeps. And the ring around her finger is a ring around her past. And a youth that couldn't last. And people ask if she's okay. She doesn't even answer. Her mind is set on other things, but heaven knows how long. With the body of an angel and the features of a child.
Earth vs. the Wild Hearts was their first album. It was released in 93, as I said, but it was re-released in 94. And then it was re-released again with bonus tracks in 2010. I picked up my copy while a student at Michigan State University at East Lansing. I want to say I picked it up at Wazoo Records. I don't remember if I read about it or heard about it somewhere or the title grabbed my attention. All I really remember is that they had a used promo copy with a damaged cover, so I only had to pay something like $6 for it. Took it home, listened to it, and really didn't get it, really didn't connect with me, really didn't make any kind of impression. But I kept the record for whatever reason, and I would play it sporadically over the years. And as time went on, I met more and more people that were part of the cult of the Wild Hearts. And over time, the record grew on me, and it's one of those records that you put on and you listen to, and there's a couple of tracks that maybe hook into you, but overall, it's the experience of listening to the record. For a number of reasons, I haven't picked up their subsequent records. I had an issue with the label that they were on in the States. That's a long story for another time. Maybe if I have enough beers in me, you will hear it. Maybe I'll dig out the old Reanimator Records podcast where my brother and I talked about that label. But anyways, so I didn't pick up subsequent records. I've been tempted to pick up the covers album that they released at some point. He said, pausing the recording to check Wikipedia, that's a little Terry Frost moment for you. Anyway, that album is called Stop Us If You've Heard This One, Volume 1. And I guess it's really not an album as much as a cover collection of covers, including covers of, well, the Icicle Works, the Distellers, Helmet, Fugazi, the Toadies, the Descendants, the Georgia Satellites, Warren Zevon, and Soul Asylum. So maybe at some time in the near future, I will pull the trigger on picking that one up. Like any good cult band, they also did inspire other artists. Talked earlier about Monty Colvin from the Galactic Cowboys, who has had a project called Crunchy, that is very inspired by and has actually name checked the Wild Hearts. Wow, no. Here she comes. Also, Nick Anderson from the Helicopters, who worked with Wild Hearts frontman Ginger in a project back around 2000. His new band, Imperial State Electric, probably owes as much to the Wild Hearts as it does to the Beatles and Cheap Trick and the rest of those kinds of bands. What I think the appeal of the mixture of this sound and the reason that these bands are all mixing the melodic pop and the heavier rock, not just the instrumentation, but also the lyrics and the themes, is that it's an interesting combination, especially when you add the right kind of energy and the right kind of emphasis. I think that the Wild Hearts are a blueprint for a sound that obviously had a following or a concept, kind of hit in the right way, the same way that the mixing of, say, the punk and the metal and the college rock with some pop really brought grunge and that first bout of alternative music to the fore. So anyway, bottom line is that for me, when I think 90s Brit pop, I think the Wild Hearts. And they're worth checking out, worth taking a look at. And yeah, go ahead and dig them out. This is Eric Reanimator, and I will talk to you later.
In a world where podcasts last over 3 hours.
You have no concept of time!
Bellaband Studios presents... A Stinking Paws.
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
Starring Scotland.
Yeah, be prepared for me to have a little bit to say about that one.
And Charles.
If Leslie Grantham can do it, then so can we.
Oh, yeah.
Bunch of cunts.
The Stinking Paws Movie Podcast, available on iTunes and Stitcher Radio.
Hotter than any uncurbed passion since Last Tango in Paris.
There's the Facebook group, and you can follow us on Twitter at Stinking Paws.
You've never laughed more at sex or a picture about it.
And download all our episodes at thestinkingpaws.blogspot.co.uk. Ah!
Back from break, Morris and Dave in Melbourne, Scott in the UK. Where actually are you based, Scott?
It's in the southeast. We're about 30 miles from London in Kent.
Okay.
A village, well, not a village, it's a town called Gillingham that I'm currently in. And Charlie's just over the water in Rochester, in a place called Strood. It's like a suburb almost of London, not too far, 35 minutes on the train, so... find ourselves going up there quite often, Charlie and I, to go to cinemas and other things. So, yeah, it's an exciting place to be. It's not too near and not too far away from the capital.
Nice, nice. All right, so as I said before the break, we're here to discuss an album from 1997. I did get that right, didn't I, Dave?
Yes, you did, Morris.
Very good. Manson, Attack of the Grey Lantern. Now,
yeah.
Dave?
The boys out of Chester.
Boys out of Chester. Okay, so that's...
Yeah, about 250 miles from where you are.
It is, yes.
I'm guessing that, Dave, you were a big Britpop fan back in the day. I want to ask, what drew you to this particular album? And in general terms, where does it stand against, you know, the other major practitioners of the form? If I can be so bold to use that as an expression. I mean, because, you know, obviously the big names are every man and his dog, and I'm including myself in that category, you know, knows Oasis and Pulp and Blur. But this was not a band I'd heard of. And yet it's strange because this was, for 1 week, a number one album in Britain. So really, where did you enter the chamber of Manson?
Yeah, well... the story behind my listening of this album was I was in a place in Fitzroy called the Red Triangle, which is a billiards pool.
I know it court. Well.
And the guys there tend to be rather fanatical about what sort of music they play, and they were spinning this album, and I think I got through about track three, and I'd heard the first three tracks with my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, and I just thought, this album sounds bloody good, I reckon I better ask them what it is. And I even sort of got through the fourth track, and it just rang a bell with me. I wasn't really a huge Britpop fan, it was just, this album just seemed to speak to me. And by the time I got round to actually asking the guys at the desk what they were spinning, I was listening to Wide Open Space, and I was just absolutely hooked on the album.
Right, okay. Well, it's interesting that you make that comment there. You know, you're saying you weren't necessarily into what was generally known as Britpop. I guess the question that we might sort of end up discussing, I mean, we'll still sort of be discussing the wide open expanse of what Britpop actually was, but there's a lot going on here. Does this actually qualify as Britpop, or is it a mashup with glam, or should we be categorizing it at all?
I think you could just about throw this into the post-Britpop type sound. The post-Britpop albums being probably more successful than the initial wave of Britpop albums, more because they weren't as nationalistic as the early Britpop type albums were, and therefore they had more success in the United States.
Mm. Okay, yeah, well, actually, yeah, that is a good point that you make, because I blur a lot of their songs are very, very local, very British, and I think probably the comparisons that have been made between Blur and the Kinks are very apt. I have to say, I've never understood the comparison between Oasis and the Beatles, apart from the fact that the Gallagher brothers were Beatles fans, but I've never understood musically the comparison between the two. But Blur and the Kinks always made sense to me.
Yeah, well, I think if you listen to the Gallagher brothers' vocals, you'd say, yeah, there's a Lennon and McCartney type sound there.
Oh, well, I don't know that I see that, but, you know, then again, what do I know? I've never counted myself as a huge Oasis fan, and certainly Liam. I mean, look, you know, I find stuff to admire in some ways. I've got a best of, but I don't own a copy of What's the Story, Morning Glory, or any of the other albums. But anyway, so the other thing that was interesting there about you saying that, you know, you'd categorize this as post Britpop. Now, what I wanted to mention was, as doing some research for our discussion today, I went and watched a film called Live Forever, which was a documentary, I guess, on the whole Britpop scene, but focusing in particular on Pulp, Oasis, and Blur. But what they tended to do as well was to mark historical moments in that movement over the, you know, few years that it was around. And that would be, you say, I don't know, about 4 years or something like that, 4 or 5 years. They also show, they interview one of the members of Massive Attack, and then they also, so they show, I might have a cover of Blurred Lines as part of that historical linear path from, you know, covering the Britpop era. And then they also make reference to Radiohead's OK Computer. Now, trip hop, as Massive Attack was, and I don't know how you'd categorize OK Computer, but neither of them really would fit into what I would have classified, or what a lot of people would classify, as Britpop. But I found it an interesting stylistic device in the documentary to be able to say, well, we're focusing on this, but this is what else was going on. Because all too often you get a documentary where they focus on something in isolation of everything else that was going on. And I think that was a clever move to say, this is what else that's going on. But in your opinions, and you know, I open this to both of you, do you think that something like, OK Computer by Radiohead was a natural, the next step, or it was a reaction to Britpop, or maybe neither? We'll start with you, Scott. What do you think?
Well, it's certainly true what Dave said. It's the second wave of Britpop. I think the high point was sort of between 94 and 97, sort of between the release of Park Life by Blur and culminating in Be Here Now by Oasis at the early part of 97, I believe it was. And certainly in this country, from what you were saying, Morris, about associating it with things going on at the time, current events, certainly over here, we were coming towards the tail end of a conservative government that had been in power for about 14 years. And there was a lot of change going on. There was a lot of unrest, as you can see in that documentary, things like the riots and things that they sort of pinpoint, you know, and sort of point out amongst the, you know, in between the tracks that they play. Britpop, to me, sort of, it didn't pass me by, but it wasn't something I was deeply involved in, but I was aware of it because it was so huge at the time. There was a phrase coined by one of the national newspapers, and Cool Britannia became one of the big buzzwords, you know, at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was reminiscent of the swinging 60s, Carnaby Street and London, from, you know, 20, 30 years earlier. Britpop, sort of a reaction to grunge music at the time. Nirvana in the early 90s and the Seattle-based sound were huge here. And Blur, Oasis, Pulp, as you say, were certainly, you know, coming to the forefront, as well as some other minor bands such as Elastica and Sleeper as well. But hugely influential, and it was a bit of a reaction. There was a bit of unrest in this country, and a lot of Britpop seems to be associated with football or soccer, because England were doing pretty well in the World Cup at the time, and some of these songs were taken on as anthems and you know, just calling points for the youth of the day.
Confidence is a preference for the habitual voyeur of what is known as... A morning suit can be avoided if you take a route straight through what is known as... John Scott Brewer's group, he gets intimidated by the dirty pigeons. They love a bit of him. Who's that gut lord marching? You should cut down on your pork life, mate. Get some exercise.
Yeah, it's very influential and very dependent on what was going on socially at the time.
Right, well, the film certainly made that point. It said that there'd been long conservative rule, was it, you know, 16, 17 years, and that is coming to an end, and Tony Blair was at the time seen as, you know, this going to be this big new dose of fresh air. I mean, obviously, over, you know, successive years of his rule, there was a lot of disenchantment with how he ran his government, but at the time he wasn't Margaret Thatcher or he wasn't John Major, so this is always going to be something wonderful. And but I can't remember what the lady's name was, what band she was in, but there was a woman who they interviewed who said that she lost heart with Noel Gallagher, where he basically, you know, Tony Blair had wanted to appear cool, so invited a whole bunch of celebrities to come to 10 Downing Place at the start of his inauguration party or something like that. And she said, I can't believe he went. So
he sold out as such. Yeah, there was that general sort of feeling that this angry young man of British pop was, you know, rubbing shoulders with fuddy-duddy British politicians.
But there's the thing. I mean, the film, and as you've already gone and made the case, that it was seen as an end of conservative rule. So where there's an end of, I mean, it's certainly like in America, you get any number of celebrities who get on the bandwagon. I mean, I know when Bill Clinton came on, everyone was rushing to be with him. And when Barack Obama came in, you had Bruce Springsteen coming on board, and you had any number. It's just a common thing over in America. But to celebrate the end of conservative rule, it's not like it's strange to think that someone would say, right, you're selling out by going to a politician at all, which, well, I mean, I guess maybe that's how I feel too, but given that there was this whole new breath of fresh air, as the documentary was trying to say, it sort of feels unusual that more musicians weren't celebrating it, if not for no other reason, the fact that it wasn't Tory rule. There was hope. There seemed to be hope for the future, so it seemed unusual that she said, well, you know, fuck you, Noel Gallagher, for going to 10 Downing Street, despite the fact that we're all supposed to be celebrating this.
It's interesting if you look at this from, say, an Australian or an American point of view. Quite often the celebrities will be heavily involved in the campaigning itself.
Mm-hmm.
One only needs to look at the famous It's Time campaign here in Australia.
Right.
And to see the whole host of Who's Who campaigning for the recently departed Gough Whitlam.
Similarly over here, the Labour Party and Tony Blair, in their campaign to get elected, adopted, I think it was called Things Can Only Get Better by D-Ream. That was their anthem. over here. And it was right. It was sort of a call to arms as such. And I think this is where, you know, what we've been saying, that the politicians and the pop stars of the time sort of linked forces and sort of spoke to the youth of the time.
So let's get to Manson itself. Now, Scott, you already mentioned, you know, about that, you know, Britpop being some sort of reaction as well to the grunge scene in Seattle. Like Britpop, I guess, you know, the grunge scene was not my thing. I mean, it couldn't pass me by in the sense that it was so much in your face, couldn't ignore it. It was there, but at the time, Pearl Jam and Nirvana were sort of not my bag. In fact, really during the '90s, it was either power pop for me, or anyone whose name started with Mississippi or Blind Boy or something like that. But I found myself, like in recent years, with, you know, the thanks of with Eric Reanimator, sort of rediscovering the Screaming Trees. Certainly I'm a big Mark Lanegan fan nowadays, but you know, through him I sort of, you know, sought out a couple of Screaming Trees albums. And even though that was sort of like labored under the whole thing of Seattle grunge, I found that they had a bit more, for me, a bit more depth. Don't send me death threats, listeners out there, and telling me I'm wrong, but it's just a personal thing. But I like the Screaming Trees, whereas, you know, Nirvana and Pearl Jam never really did it that much for me. Although I guess nowadays, I guess I'm more happy to listen to Nirvana, but Pearl Jam never really meant anything to me. Sorry, people out there. Sorry, John Ross. Here's something different. I guess it's the opposite for me with the Brit pop scene. I still wouldn't count myself as an Oasis fan, but I've got a greatest hits, and I admire and respect Blur, I guess, for the Kinks connection. But as I think I might have made note to you this week, Dave, because I think you'd probably been under the impression, you've been telling me for months, we've got to cover Manson. I've struggled a bit with this album, and we'll sort of discuss over the next, you know, however period of time, however long we decide to talk for, my thoughts about it, Scott's thoughts about it. But let's start this off positively, because I know that this is an album that you're really, really enamored with. So you've already gone and told us where it was that you came on board, how you first heard it. So give us your appraisal of the album in general, what it is that it really speaks to you, songwriting, performance-wise. Just go for it. The floor is open to you.
Okay. I suppose songwriting, it has a narrative in some form to tell. It's a little bit concept-y, so I suppose it does speak to me in that sort of regard. Mm-hmm. It has a nice mix of the symphonic and the rock, and they're really catchy tunes.
Right. Okay. I mean, look, I'll put this to you. I was listening again today in the car to an album that is often cited as an inspiration for the whole Britpop movement, certainly for the Gallagher brothers, and that's the first album from the Stone Roses. And what really, just listening to that again, it occurred to me that what I really liked about that was it's the simplicity of it. And I mean, I know that there's, you know, far more, this isn't going to be a Stone Roses show, so I'm not sort of going to get into any depth about it, but the simplicity of the tunes, the strong melodies, and the fact that it was an album that was focused on the band as a band, whereas for me, I guess the Manson album, and I guess this is no crime because there are plenty of albums that I like that do focus on having a layered approach, and you know, they're really very produced, but for me, I guess the production gets in the way of songs, and I'd be very interested to hear how this album would have sounded if there hadn't been layers and layers of guitars overdubbing each other. And once again, as I said, that's not a sin unto itself. It's just for me, I don't think these songs worked so much with that multi-layered overproduction approach. But it's something that you love. So I'm really still sort of trying to throw. Give me some examples of some songs where you really think it works and
that you love. I really do think the wide open space works brilliantly in this regard. I'm in a wide open space. I think what you get with this is a song that's talking about being in the wide open, yet the lyrics and the layering really do make you feel claustrophobic. The lyrics come from all different directions in the mix. Mm-hmm. The sounds come from all sides and they hit you. And you feel like, yes, you're in a wide open space, but you're surrounded.
Okay. I know that you sent me a link to YouTube to a remixed version of that song. So tell us about your feelings about the remix and remixes in general.
Yeah, I'm not a huge remix fan. I suppose this song was one that really did benefit from being remixed, the Perfecto remix by Paul Oakenfield. And it really, I suppose, enabled the song to take off in, the dance floor. And there was really sort of a whole big other scene that wasn't about the rock music, that wasn't the Britpop. It was, more about the ecstasy dance floor scene.
Mm. Once again, without wanting to sound like a negative Nelly too much, but you know, the whole dance scene was also not a movement that I ever particularly cared for. But listening to this, I can certainly see how it would be an album that would appeal to the dance music listeners out there. I could see where this would be ripe for remixes, or even it could be played on the dance floor without a remix. Do you think that Wide Open Spaces could have worked without the remix in that context?
Yeah, very much so. They seem to have this sort of writing style that was all about pulling together little fragments or building layers upon layers or recording, say, four bars here, four bars there, and meshing them all together.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm going to make mention, because I think when we first spoke about doing the album, and I'd gone and listened to it a couple of times, and I think one track that you said that you really, really loved, and I'll confess, even though, you know, as I said, this is not necessarily in the overall an album that I particularly cared for, but I do really like the album opener, the Chad Who Loved Me.
I really adore that song too. The simple two chord introduction, which they, flogged off You Only Live Twice, and I guess with the naming of the song itself, The Chad Who Loved Me,
from
another James Bond film, The Spy Who Loved Me.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a bit of Sean Connery and a bit of Roger Moore here, and the song itself being more or less pinched from the title track there. Mm-hmm. The Nancy Sinatra song. And I suppose that was the first thing that had me hooked, was the simple synth strings intro blending in with the guitar. And
are they synth strings?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, they've done I'll give a bit of respect there. They've done a really good job, because it sounds like a real string section to me.
Yeah, as far as I can tell, according to the liner notes, it was
okay.
All done with synth.
Okay.
And yeah, the simplicity of just the C major G minor combination, it just really, really works.
Right. Look, I think it's actually it's a terrific start to the record, and you know, the combination of, you know, that string section, be it synthesized or real, heading into the band, it sounds, and besides the title being The Chad Who Loved Me, the music itself in that sense does sound very cinematic, and it does sound as if you're, you know, we're about to start a Western film. So that initial riff, once the guitar player comes in, it sounds like something out of a Western. And I have to say, though, that one of the things I didn't like here, it's probably a criticism of the album in general, is Paul Draper's voice. It's, I know, it just sort of had that affected style. It's something you get in a lot of glam music. And while I'd be, you know, foolhardy to say that it's, you know, that it's false or bad or anything, it doesn't appeal to me. He sort of has this affected sound throughout the album. And I know that there's, you know, any number of singers who, you know, won't sing in a natural way. I mean, I don't even know what that means, because, you know, when you're singing, you're not using a natural voice anyway, but it just sounds like it's been extra affected. And in this case, it doesn't appeal to me. I'll actually sort of make reference to a specific song later on when we get to it, but he reminds me of another British singer from an iconic British band of the 80s. I'll come to the specific song later on in the show. But yeah, look, that voice sort of took me away from what I otherwise thought was a really great album opening. And it's nice to see that the tradition of the reprise in a concept album, or even if it's not a concept album, is alive and healthy, because they bring it up again at the end of the album, don't they?
Yeah, well, they bring it up in, I suppose you'd call it, the final track, Dark Mavis.
Yeah.
It's interesting how with that track, it's really almost like a stumble to the finish line. You're getting towards the end of the marathon here, and it is like a stumbling across. However, with the reprisal of the original riff, I suppose you'd call it, it really does seem to close the circle on the album, and it brings everything together nicely.
We should sort of say, I guess, because you've already gone and mentioned that this is a sort of concept album. I mean, it's not a concept album in the sense that there's a story. We're not talking Tommy or Quadrophenia or anything like that. But it's,
no.
I guess it's more like in the sense that the Kinks are the Village Green Preservation Society is a concept album. A bunch of characters, a bunch of like individual stories set in, you know, one area. That's at least the way I see it. Was that...
Yeah, it's how I sort of feel it. It seems to be capturing English village life. And I guess it really does have that sort of Midsummer Murders type feel of the location. You've got to be wary of the various characters that you might sort of see around the place.
Scott, I'll open the floor to you on this one, because, you know, I guess, you know, here in the colonies, we have an impression as to, you know, the feel of, you know, what, you know, through, maybe through TV shows or literature or just, you know, a general history with England, that what would constitute something that has the British sound and the quaint British story, you know, that we might see through through BBC television programs. But do you think that there's something valid that this album does represent a small British village feel, or are we talking through our ass?
No, it certainly does. I mean, it is a concept album in a way, but it's done very tongue-in-cheek. Some of the lyrics are quite poetic, introducing these varied characters that you meet in this typical English-type village. Midsummer Murders is perhaps a perfect comparison to make, because that was the whole feeling I was getting listening to the album. Very sort of Miss Marple, Agatha Christie type people that you'd meet in one of her novels. I just want to go back quickly, but what you were saying about The Chad Who Loved Me, that orchestral beginning was absolutely fantastic. And from what you were saying, Morris, for me it was almost spoilt by the introduction of the lyrics. It just took me out of that particular track at one point, and I'm going to stake my claim on that particular piece of orchestral music and use it in a Stinking Paws episode at some point in the future.
Nice.
But it's interesting, you know, you meet these characters, and if you look into the lyrics, and they're leading quite depraved lives, you know, stripping vicars and, you know, tax loss and other, you know, tracks that introduce these people along the way. I'm just going to ask, Dave, when do you think... I know the album was originally conceived as a concept album, but they sort of lost their way somewhere amongst it, didn't they? When do you think the album sort of shifted at some point?
I think it's sort of shifted in terms of the likes of Wide Open Space, Manson's Only Love Song, those sort of tracks.
Yeah.
And what you're sort of left with was, according to Paul Draper, not so much a concept album, more of a con album, you described it as.
So it's the great 90s rock and roll swindle.
Yeah, but you can see that it was more or less conceived or was going to be a concept album, and I think they just had a few extra tracks that just didn't quite fit the billing, but they've gone, these songs are too good to leave out.
Mm.
So rather than leaving those songs for a future album and revisiting them, they've decided to more or less go with the songs that they had instead.
So at least from a lyrical perspective, Scott, do you think that some of these songs could have worked in a David Lynch film?
A British version of a David Lynch film. I'll tell you what some of them actually reminded me of. Strip a Vicar, for a start. In the hoping you may soon be getting better. Have a feeling you should go to your doctor. If you have a baby, though you really ought to. I was worried, so I went to see the vicar. But before I could confess, he just confessed to be a stripper. Dear neighbors, it is very strange to see me. Should I press on him, report him to the governor? Or whether I should egg him on to the professional? If I love on him, they'll call him back. Right, two groups of the 90s that I'm not too sure if you guys would be aware of. There was one called Space, and there was one called The Divine Comedy.
I know The Divine Comedy through their songs, Songs of Love. I actually had a note here about it, because they were classified as part of the Britpop movement, yeah. And they don't really sound like anything else.
No, but they reminded, the Stripper Vicar in particular, reminded me of something that Neil Hannon would have penned for Divine Comedy. Songs like National Express, you know, where he has these characters on a bus and he describes, you know, all the goings-on and their history and their sordid lives. And Stripper Vicar's almost smutty in a sort of seaside postcard humour type of way, almost like a Carry On film or Benny Hill, something like that, when you look at some of the lyrics of what's going on in there. I'm just trying to think of one there. When the vicar strips, he gets away with it. There's loads of different references to what this vicar's up to, and it's quite dark in places as well.
This is one of the songs on the album that I really did like, if more from a lyrical perspective rather than the music. And I can't quite work it out, but the feel or the melody of the song sounds like something that else that I can't quite place, but it did give me a really big chuckle. It's a one-gag song, but still, I guess it's melodically inventive enough and cute enough about the guy writing to the vicar's daughter saying, you know, he went to confession, but her old man was too busy getting into the all together. You know, something, and really, there's something very Monty Python-esque about that, or you know, as well as Lynchian about it. So I do appreciate that dark sense of humour on that song.
And it's a real thumbing its nose to authority. In the way that it says, well, look, somebody of such stature in the community can get away with being such a pervert.
My favourite line, and he's making wine from water while he dresses like his daughter, and we know that he's a rip-off because we've seen him with his kit off.
I mean, you know what? That lyric could have worked really well, I think, in a Blur song. I think it's a very Blur-esque lyric, isn't it?
It's just sheer poetry. That's what it is.
It's fantastic. So I just wanted to move on just for a little bit from Stripper Pick. I'm actually sort of going back. Mm-hmm. We were speaking before, Dave, you've mentioned about, you know, the song that you find absolutely perfect, you know, Wide Open Space. I couldn't remember what it, now I remember it was, that was a song I wanted to make reference to where I had, I mean, I guess another problem with the lead vocal. He sounds like he's going, and see what you think about this. He sounds like he's trying to sound like, is his name Tony Hadley? The lead Spandau singer Ballet. Of Spandau Ballet. Very much to me like this could have been a Spandau Ballet outtake, or, you know, one of their hits maybe from the early 80s. Am I imagining that, or do you think that sounds a little bit like him on that song?
Yeah, I think there is a little bit of that sort of sound. Also, I thought a little bit sort of Bernard Sumner out of New Order somewhat.
And actually, I guess the other thing that it reminds me of is because, you know, he has that tenor type voice and he's very big into the drama, which Hadley was. But it also reminds me a little bit of Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Now, regardless of whether it, you know, directly sounds like that, but I'd have to imagine that those guys would have had to have had that Welcome to the Pleasure Dome album in their collections at some stage.
You'd imagine that sort of sound.
Yeah, the production values are certainly reminiscent of what Trevor Horn was doing with Frankie Goes to Hollywood. In the mid-80s. Another band that came to mind, and I'm going to mention another track here, Morris, it's on Disgusting. That reminded me of Tears for Fears from that sort of era. If you
got, okay,
oh yes,
yeah. Did you get that sort of vibe, Dave? I think that was very Tears for Fears esque.
Yeah, the very soaring vocals that they use, and the long drawn out lyrics.
Yeah,
yeah, very much Tears for Fears esque.
But even Tears for Fears sort of went through, you know, a couple of their different phases. So. You know, their version of Mad World, you know, was that electronica style, and then they sort of went all jangly, Beatlesque poppy later on, did they?
Yeah, and that's very reminiscent of that era, I think. Disgusting is very, very similar. That's the first thing that came into my head when I heard the track.
Right. Okay, so you've already gone and mentioned this track by name, Scott, but I want to just briefly make reference to... tax law. We'll be a tax loss lover from Liverpool. Tax loss lover, if the truth be told. Tax loss lover still lives in the war. Tax loss lover, touch his 74.
Come back to me, we want your money.
Now, this is another song I guess I don't mind. Like much of the genre that I've heard, it's got this bold stadium sound, which, you know, while it's not my favourite thing, I guess that sort of works here. The actual singing of the line, "Tax Loss," though, you know, not the rest of the tune, is definitely a tip of the hat to the Beatles, which, you know, is never a bad thing in my book. Yet, the strange thing about this, and we've already gone and mentioned the whole concept of remixes, this song decides that it's going to become its own remix. So it starts out like a big stadium rock song, and then all of a sudden it goes into a remix beat. Dave, what were they thinking? And do you think it's a good thing?
I don't think it's too bad a thing. It's being able to get that repeating sound into your head, and I suppose being able to suggest that to any would-be producer with a laptop who wants to cut up their sound.
Right.
I think the most interesting thing about this tune was its actual film clip, where they actually threw 25,000 pounds in 5-pound notes into a crowd down the tube.
Holy moly.
Yeah, I remember
actually,
that
there's actually something I didn't think to do was look and see what any of the film clips were from the album. I might have to follow up on that.
Yeah, some of their film clips had been fairly inventive. Also, very interesting listening is much of their live material, to see how they reproduced it live. And generally, they did, I suppose, very good versions of their songs. There is a bit of a meme throwing around. There is one bloke who comments on every single version of Wide Open Space, "Gee, the bass player never makes a mistake."
And this is supposed to be something revelatory.
Yeah, well, I suppose it is about as simple a bass line as you can get. But I suppose by having the bass as it is, it enables the layering to occur and that sort of claustrophobic feeling to build up. Whereas if the bass was jumping about all over the place, everything would get in the way of each other.
Talking about Tax Loss there, Morris, it's easy to see the Beatles' influences there, obviously, with Tax Man, the Beatles song. But did you guys, as you were saying, Morris, it developed into its own remix. I heard elements of We Love You by the Rolling Stones as it went into that final part of the track.
I'm going to have to go back to that. I honestly say I didn't think that ever occurred to me.
Take another listen.
I'm trying to hear the song in my head.
Take another listen, and when you listen to that swirling melody that's in We Love You by the Rolling Stones, it becomes Beatles into the Stones.
Okay. I'll give that another listen and report my thoughts. But I'm thinking of the tune in my head now, and I'm still struggling to hear it. But
yeah.
I'll give that another try for sure.
I may be wrong, but that was the first impression I got from it.
Yeah, the other band that I tend to hear a bit in this is plenty of Pink Floyd, the way that they seem to have the completion of the songs as being, I suppose, a little bit conversational, the way that they lead into many of the songs like Disgusting. It just seemed to have that sort of Pink Floyd track-to-track type feel to it.
There's a lot of ambient sound, a lot of feedback and sort of background noise going on in between the tracks as they mix into each other. I think that's quite evident, Dave, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, yeah. I guess that moment as they finish off the Chad Who Loved Me going into Manson's Only Love song, that certainly seems to sound very very Dark Side of the Moon, just as, you know, they go from Speak to Me to Breathe in the Air, that build up and that scream, or rather, I think in Manson's case, is it a cat meowing or something like that?
Yeah, that sort of sound.
Yeah.
And just wondering what your thoughts are of the guitar playing throughout. just that ringing, soaring guitar type feel.
Look, from a technical standpoint, there's nothing that I'd fault from a musicianship perspective. But once again, I think there's a whole lot of layering, a whole lot of overproduction, and I just would have liked to have heard these songs maybe with more restraint. And I think where it's overproduced, I mean, I'm not saying I haven't heard albums, once again, that tend to go that way, that I don't find appealing, but in this case, I just found that the songs didn't get a chance to breathe, and I honestly can't say whether the songs aren't melodically interesting. I don't find them melodically interesting, but that's possibly because of the way that they're delivered. Sometimes it's about the presentation, and the presentation here just doesn't do it for me. So the guitar playing itself is fine, but I think that there's a lack of taste, a lack of restraint, and I personally think that, given that so many of the songs are about comedic subject matter, like we've already spoken about Stripper Vicar, it's very small village sort of feel. It's not big stadium thump your fist in the air. I would have liked to have heard that produced with a bit more restraint, a little bit. The humor would have had a greater chance to shine through, but that's my thought.
Well, also, I suppose you've got to be looking at where they'd be playing to their biggest audiences. And this is music that's trying to be played at Glastonbury.
Right. Well, okay. So, I mean, this is their first album. It wasn't like they built up to this and all of a sudden they had a million fans overnight. So they had to cater to that. But you've got cases of bands played to stadiums and then go and produce something that's far more humbled and far more restrained. Someone went and posted on the Love That Album Facebook page, just today about, their favorite Springsteen album was, Tunnel of Love. And after, the stadium grandiose that was born in the USA, to go to Tunnel of Love, Springsteen decided, I'm not going to keep on with this big stadium thing. I'm going to come up with something that's a whole lot more personal and make an album that sounds like it's just by an indie. He'd already put out The River, and what does he do next? He releases this demo album, Nebraska. So you can still get a big time artist, and certainly like Manson, this is a first album. Decided, they didn't want to tell a small story, if that's what you're saying is the case. And even, we were talking before about the Stone Roses. That doesn't sound like a big stadium album to me.
I'd be interested to hear what their next two albums actually sounded like, because I'm totally unaware of them and sort of what direction they take from this big grandiose spectacle that they've released here. Whether they did tone it down a bit and actually go back to basics and make it more guitar driven or acoustic even. I don't know. Yeah. Dave, have you got the other albums, mate?
I don't have the other albums, but I've listened to a bit of them, and they did try to go more guitar-based, more rock-type sounding, and they just didn't have the quality of songwriting, and they were trying to, I suppose, piece together little bits of music, little bits of lyrics, and it just wasn't as coherent as this whole first album. And I suppose when you throw in the pressures of the record company were putting on them to get out material, they all sort of, I suppose, collapsed in a heap, which is what sort of happened to the band as they were recording their fourth album, which they were reportedly most happy with that material as it was coming out. So if Paul Draper is listening, we would like to hear it, mate.
Didn't it end up like on a, there was a, I did a little bit of research and apparently there's a box set or there's going to be a box set. I don't remember if there was or it's coming. And wasn't there supposed to be like a whole bunch of this material that didn't see the light of day for that very reason that's going to be on that? Do you know anything of that, Dave?
Yeah, I believe that is sort of the case, but I guess we're going off rumour and what the internet's got to say. So.
Oh, the internet never lies, Dave. Yeah, come on. It's reliable completely. Okay, so, look, I've got a few more notes, but are there any final thoughts that either of you want to make about the album? I'll go to you first, Scott. I think the final word should belong to Dave, but any final thoughts overall about the album or a specific song that we haven't covered yet?
Just in general, Morris, I mean, it's a very ambitious album. insanely ambitious, I think I read somewhere on the internet as they were describing it as. It's a nice snapshot of where Britpop was at the tail end of, you know, the hype. And the interesting fact that I found out, to give you some idea of where music was going over here in the UK at this time, the week after Manson were number one in the album charts, the following week it was the Spice Girls with their debut album. So we cling on to Manson, you know, just as a in a vain hope that there was something good out there. But I loved it. I mean, I've rediscovered it for the first time since 1997. I listened to it at the time and just forgot completely about the album. And it was a joy to listen to. There's some great tracks. It was a bit overblown in places, lost its way somewhere towards the middle, but picked up again with a great couple of final tracks. And I thoroughly enjoyed listening to it again, mate.
Dave, your final appraisal, but I'll lead you in with a question. Do you think that the album still sounds fresh to you today?
I think the album sounds incredibly fresh. It's very much timeless in terms of its recording values. And you can place the village feel, and you could say this was occurring in the 1920s. You could say it was occurring in the 60s. You could say it was occurring in the 80s. You'd still have those sort of small town characters applicable, I think, for many years to come. I love the sound of Egg-Shaped Fred, and just the way that Draper was able to more or less base a song upon a nursery rhyme that he was actually teased with, because according to his schoolmates, he had an egg-shaped head.
Mm-hmm.
The one thought that I'd really like to leave you with was to the very peculiar 90s phenomenon of the hidden track.
Writing the words like the fool that I am, trying to say something good like the person, but it's all just a sham, cause the writer I am not could say anything you believe in. Just too late to pick a mess again.
Yeah, the open letter to the lyrical train spotter.
Right. Which pretty much the lyric of that was probably taking a dig at shows like this where we're trying to analyse the album. It's very anti-podcast, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's also, they've produced this huge, almost concept-type album, had some very sort of serious lyrics, some, I suppose, very serious messages that they wanted to convey, and then they all say, well, it was just really a bit of a joke, and it's almost unfulfilling in a way to actually listen to that track.
Because you've been saying, you've just been wasting your time for the last three quarters of an hour. We've just been having a joke.
Yeah, but I suppose it also highlights that they can see their own sense of humour, that they can poke fun at themselves and say, look, we're really just a band writing music.
All right. Well, I think at that point we can say we've pretty much discussed as much as we can say about Manson's Attack of the Grey Lantern. Look, despite my reservations about it, if you're a fan of music of that era and you haven't caught it yet, search it out, see what you think. As I said, you know, it's not my cup of tea too much, but it's, you know, certainly not without without merit. I mean, you know, I've already gone and mentioned there were some things about it that I liked, but, you know, I've already gone and stated over the course of the time what my reservations were, but it's something that Dave is absolutely passionate about, and Scott also sees some merit. So, yeah, look, go search it out, see what you think. Go on.
Yeah, I think also you've got to consider the sea of dross that was released in the 90s itself.
The Spice Girls, I rest my case.
Well, hang on, was 97 not... 97 was also the year of OK Computer, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Yeah.
So there you go. I imagine that you know, we've already gone and said that, you know, despite being a number one album, Manson are pretty much, it would seem to have been a long forgotten band. And I wonder if the attention being focused at a band like Radiohead saying, right, we're going to take the movement in this direction, nothing more to see here, people, move on, is why they were, you know, maybe never really paid that much attention to after that. All right, anyway, thank you very much, gentlemen, for that discussion. I shall quickly make mention of a couple of housekeeping things. If you've enjoyed the program, and I certainly hope that you have, please feel free to send some feedback. The email here is rrrkitchen@yahoo.com.au. You can join the Facebook page, start up a music conversation on the page. We're at facebook.com/groups/lovethatalbum. What else? If you listen to the show and you think, I can talk about an album, then feel free, come on the groups, send me an email, suggest an album. And if you think you can talk articulately for a little while about an album, I'll invite you on. You know, we're very friendly here at Love That Album headquarters. I haven't really gone and put a grill through Scott or Dave. You know, I'm a nice guy. Even my cat that's sitting next to me thinks so, as soon as I take the manacles off it. What else? Yeah, I think that's pretty much covered it. So we should talk about next month. So we're recording. This is October. I'm hopefully going to have this out in the last week of October 2014. Out on the podcast waves, which you all know, of course, if you're listening to it. So November's show is another album, which I guess is big on production, but in a very different way. We're going to be talking about an American, well, I know they're lumbered into the power pop camp, but there'll be some debate as to whether they really were a power pop band. And the band I'm talking about is Jellyfish and their second album, Spilt Milk. So we'll have a lot to say about that. My guest for that show will be another first-timer, a fellow who is a Melbourne-based musician. He's a working guy. I mean, as we speak now, he's about to go on stage doing his regular Saturday night gig in, I've forgotten the name, the Elephant in the Wheelbarrow. You know that venue, Dave?
Know it very well, Morris.
There you go. So a fellow called Reese Lett is going to be joining me to discuss Jellyfish's Spilt Milk, their second album, unfortunately their last album. They didn't last beyond that, which is a big shame, but we'll no doubt be also speaking a little bit, you know, just for the reference's sake, about their first album called Belly Button. But the members of Jellyfish have really had, even for only two albums, their members like John Breon and Jason Faulkner and Andy Sturmer, have had wide influence on other bands and have played on a whole bunch of other bands' recordings and live settings. So there'll be plenty to talk about that. And whilst I can't say for 100% that this is going to take place, but last month when I recorded with Scott Clickers, when we were talking about the Neil Young Freedom album, we were going to talk about a second album by Canadian husband and wife duo called Whitehorse and their terrific album called The Fate of the World Depends Upon This Kiss, which is such a great name for an album alone. It's worth talking about. But we ran out of time because we spoke for so long about Neil Young. So I'm going to see if I can get Scott to come back and I'll talk for, you know, part of the show with Reese about Jellyfish and just see if I can get a quick segment talking with Scott Clickers about the Whitehorse album. So we can get two albums in on that program. And that'll lead into December. Time for our Shooting the Shit special, end of year special, to talk about favorite first time listens of the year. And it'll be the first time convening with the Shooting the Shit crew for all of 2014. I can't believe that I haven't sort of done one of those programs all year. For those of you not familiar with the concept, it's just where myself and four or five other people, the regulars will be Eric Reanimator, Tim Merrill, Jeff Smith, and John, who the fuck is Wilco Stirrett. And we'll just be talking about our favorite first-time listens. Not necessarily favorite 2014 albums, although they can be included. But we just want to talk about albums that we heard for the first time this year, our top five or six albums. And that'll be, no doubt, a mammoth show in December. And what I'd like you, the listeners, to do if you feel so inclined, and I hope you do, is to send me in a list of your favorite first time listens for the year. I don't care if you want to send it to me in an email, then I'll read it out. Or if you want to send me an MP3 file where you talk for yourself about it, that'll be absolutely brilliant. I love feedback at this show because it means that, you know, here I'm doing a Sally Field. You like me. So yeah, any feedback that you want to send about your favorite album, we'll be recording that early December sometime. So you have a few weeks to have a bit of a think about it and get in your list, and you can send that to rrrkitchen@yahoo.com.au. I think that's all the housekeeping. Once again, Scott, Stinking Paws, people can find you on iTunes and your Blogspot site.
Blogspot, again, thestinkingpaws.blogspot.co.uk. Facebook group is something we want to encourage people to join and take part in actively, so seek us out there. And Twitter, @StinkingPaws.
So what I might do is also put on a link on the Love That Album Facebook page, so people can follow up once they've gone and listened to this. But I really do urge the listeners out there to give the Stinking Paws a try, because, I mean, one thing that I really, really love about yours and Charlie's show is the banter. It sounds like I'm there with you. You're at the pub. I want to interject, but I'm thinking, oh, no, I can't. It's a recording. But it really sounds like the two of you are in the pub having a pint and just having a friendly conversation about a film. And I just find that so endearing. And I know that Scott Clickers feels the same way. That's really just why we love it so much.
Yeah,
so
that's nice of you to say, mate. I mean, it's a shame that Charlie couldn't be here today, and he does send his apologies. But we're both looking forward to a return visit in the new year, hopefully.
Oh, 100%. It is definitely going to happen. We'll I'll come through with a whole bunch of suggestions, or you two guys can come up with a whole bunch of suggestions. We'll pick one or two and just get on with it.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So, Dave, any artistic projects that you want to plug? Anything going on? You putting a band together or something?
Yeah, no, I've got a special one to actually plug for Scott. We've got one of Melbourne's finest bands currently touring, and I'll be heading your way in about 3 weeks' time. They're called Electric Mary, and they'll be playing Borderline in London on the 13th of November.
So it gives Scott a bit of a picture. Electric Mary, stylistically, what are they?
Aussie rock.
I'm writing this down now, Dave. Don't worry. Borderline, one of my favourite venues.
So you understand, Scott, that Aussie rock is spelled, the rock is spelled R-A-W-K. Aussie rock.
It'll be interesting. I'll try and drag Charlie up there.
Fantastic. All right. Well, once again, thank you so much, gentlemen, for taking your Saturday night and Saturday morning to join me on the program. It was a wonderful conversation. Really, really loved it. And I'll try to get this online a couple of days after our recording of it. So that should be, I don't know, hopefully Monday or Tuesday in this last week of October. And once again, you listeners out there, thank you so much for downloading. Please spread the word that we exist. Always love to have new listeners and new participants, for that matter, on board. So we'll see you again in November for a little bit of jellyfish and hopefully some White Horse talk as well. Be nice to each other. Take care. Read some great books. Watch some wonderful films. Listen to some great records. Go see a gig. And we'll speak to you in November. All the best. Cheers.